Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tonight is a very special program, a reading by the judges of the Kingsley and Kate Tufts Poetry Prizes administered by the Claremont Graduate University. We welcome the board of the Claremont Graduate University, which was meeting here tonight. Our format tonight, there won't be a Q&A after the readings, but the poets will be signing their books in the lobby of the auditorium. And books are on sale tonight, courtesy of our library store, with proceeds benefiting the Los Angeles Public Library. To introduce our three distinguished poets, Linda Gregerson, Paul Muldoon, and Robert Pinsky, and to tell you more about the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, I'm going to now turn the podium over to Mark Redfield, the Dean of the School of Arts and Humanities and Professor of English at Claremont Graduate University. Please welcome Mark Redfield. Thank you.
My thanks very much to Louise Steinman and the Allowed series for arranging these readings by three of our judges of the Kingsley and Kate Tufts Poetry Awards. I just want to say one quick word about these awards. I don't want to hold us up, but these awards mean a great deal to us at Claremont Graduate University. Tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the Colburn School here in downtown LA, we'll bestow on their winners the 17th annual Kingsley and Kate Tufts Poetry Awards, the $100,000 Kingsley Tufts Prize for a mid-career book of poetry to Matea Harvey, and for her book Modern Life, and the $10,000 Kate Tufts Discovery Prize for a first book of poetry to Matthew Dickman for his book All American Poem. The ceremony is free and open to the public. Our MC for the 2009 ceremony is the distinguished poet David St. John, and we will have readings from the two winners as well as some words on poetry by Robert Pinsky and cocktails afterwards. So I hope everybody can attend. We're having a slight modification in our program tonight. I want to ask David St. John to come to the podium to say a word in memory of Deborah Diggs, who was our 1996 Kingsley Tufts winner. David will say a word and, I believe, read a poem of Deborah's.
When Mark asked me if I would say something about Deborah, he had no way of knowing that I first met Deborah Diggs not quite 30 years ago. And I was in Columbia, Missouri, to read for my friend Larry Levis, who was teaching there. And I said, "Well, Larry, how are your students?" And he said, "Well, there's one woman in the graduate program who, she has a couple kids, she's married to a career Air Force guy, but I think she's off the charts." He says, "I think she's going to be a really great poet." And of course, he was right. Some years later, Deborah married my friend Stan Plumley, and I saw her during this period as well. Deborah had a kind of passion, a clarity, a wit, an irony that runs through all of her four books of poetry. When she published Vesper Sparrows, there was a unanimous sense of surprise and gratitude for that book. Her second book was called Late in the Millennium. And her third, Rough Music, is the book that was awarded the Kingsley Tufts Prize. Her last book, called Trapeze, is about the death of her third husband, Franklin Lowe, who'd been the dean of the veterinary schools at Tufts and Cornell, later became president of Becker College. When he died of cancer in 2003, it seemed a loss that was impossible to recoup. Deborah also wrote two stunning books of memoir, one called Fugitive Spring, about growing up in Missouri in a family of 12 children. And one of the most memorable books of memoirs of the last 20, 25 years, called The Stardust Lounge, about her son, a very troubled son, his path into drugs and gangs in Brookline, Mass. And I just highly recommend those as well as her poetry. I'd like to read the title poem of her last book, Trapeze. I found out about Deborah's death the next morning, very early in the next morning. Her lifelong friend, Robin Bain, who's a friend of mine, emailed me. And she had just heard a few minutes before she emailed me from Deborah's son. But at the time, we didn't know that it was a suicide. We just knew that Deborah was gone. And this is the poem, Trapeze. See how the first dark takes the city in its arms and carries it into what yesterday we called the future. Oh, the dying are such acrobats. Here, you must take a boat from one day to the next, or clutch the girders of the bridge, hand over hand. But they are sailing like a pendulum between eternity and evening, diving, recovering, balancing the air. Who can tell at this hour seabirds from starlings, wind from revolving doors, or currents of the river? Some are as children on swings, pumping higher and higher. Don't call them back. Don't call them in for supper. See? They leave scuff marks like jet trails on the sky. Deborah Dix.
Well, I have three very distinguished poets to introduce tonight, and I'm going to strike a balance between recognition and brevity. So these are going to be kind of really simple introductions. I'm first going to introduce Paul Muldoon, Kingsley Tufts Awards judge and 2003 Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry. Paul Muldoon was educated at Queen's University of Belfast and from 1973 to 1986 worked in Belfast as a radio and television producer for the BBC. Since 1987, he's lived in the United States, where he holds a chair at Princeton University and directs the Peter B. Lewis Center for the Arts. In 2007, he was appointed poetry editor for The New Yorker. Between 1999 and 2004, he was professor of poetry at the University of Oxford, where he's an honorary fellow of Hereford College. His main collections of poetry are, and I think I'll read the titles, many titles, New Weather, Mules, Why Brownlee Left, Quoof, Meeting the British, Madoc, A Mystery, The Annals of Chile, Hay, Poems, 1968-1998, and Moisan and Gravel, 2002, for which he won the 2003 Pulitzer Prize. His 10th collection, Horse Latitudes, appeared in the fall of 2006. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and was given an American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature in 1996. Some other recent awards are the 1994 T.S. Eliot Prize, the 1997 Irish Times Poetry Prize, the 2003 Griffin International Prize, the 2004 American-Ireland Fund Literary Award, the 2004 Shakespeare Prize, the 2005 Aspen Prize for Poetry, and the 2006 European Prize for Poetry. What's in 2007? I don't have anything. But he's been described by the Times Literary Supplement as the most significant English language poet born since the Second World War. So please welcome Paul Muldoon.
Thank you, thank you, thank you very much indeed. What a great delight it is to be here on this occasion with this wonderful group of poets. I'm thinking about Deborah Diggs and David St. John's words about her. But I guess we have to be in the moment, and I'm going to try to move on from that. Where to begin? I'm going to read for about 20 minutes, as is each of us. Let me read one or two poems set back in Ireland, Northern Ireland, where I was brought up. And this first one has to do with going to the movies. I suppose it was the point at which L.A. and this little village called the Moy connected in some way. I was born in 1951, so when I was 10, and into my teens, one of the great delights of going to the movies was to see a Western. One could be pretty certain that one would be seeing someone riding in or out of the sunset if one went to the movies. It was an era, if you recall, where they were making several Westerns a week. And what an era it was. What has happened to us? Well, much has happened to us, I guess. But anyway, this is a poem about going to the movies in this little village of the Moy, expecting to see a Western of the old school. I guess that's what happened to us. We can't do it anymore. And having a little bit of a shock. So it's called The Weepies. The Weepies. Most Saturday afternoons at the local hippodrome saw the Pathé News rooster, then the recurring dream of a lonesome drifter through uninterrupted range. Will Hunter, so gifted he could peel an orange in a single fluent gesture, was the leader of our gang. The curtain rose this afternoon on a lion, not a gong. When the crippled girl, who wanted to be a dancer, met the married man who was dying of cancer, our hankies unfurled like flags of surrender. I believe something fell asunder in even Will Hunter's hands. So about this same time, I was... one of the few books we had in the house was called The Golden Book of California. And I knew much more about Californian history and politics and everything else about this state than I did about Ireland, for example. I had no sense whatsoever about the history of Ireland. The book had been given to me by a cousin who'd spent a lot of time in this country and indeed in this town. And I'll read a little prose poem, if I may, having to do with some aspects of her experience. It's called The Key. The Key. And I refer in it to a Foley artist. And I needn't tell you, I'm sure, that a Foley artist specializes in sound, spot effects on a movie named after a man called Foley. And actually, this guy's called Foley, though he's not the Foley. I just want to make that clear. before we go much further. He's not the Foley after which Foley, the Foley technique, was named. He's another Foley. Now, there's a couple of sections of the poem that are written in verse. I'd have to say doggerel, if I were been entirely honest, I suppose. Or you'll soon see yourselves. The rest of it is written in prose, I suppose, of sorts. And at one moment, it's perhaps a good idea to be thinking of the word Muldoon in reverse. Because there is a theory that the word hoodlum, which was first used in San Francisco, as it turns out, in about 1873 or 4, it's thought by some people who have nothing else to think about but these things, that it might be a back version of Muldoon. So that's one of my main California connections. And I'm going to try to stop making them after this poem. So the key. I ran into Foley 6 months ago in a dubbing suite in Los Angeles. He was halfway through post-production on a remake of The Hoodlum Priest, a film for which I have a special affection since my cousin, Marina McCall, was an extra in the first version. She had worked as a nanny for various movie stars, including Tippi Hedren, and seemed to spend half her time in the sky between New York and L.A. Though I sat through 3 or 4 showings of The Hoodlum Priest in the Olympic Cinema, Moy, and carefully scrutinized the crowd scenes, I was never able to point to Marina with anything like conviction. Foley was working on a sequence involving a police lineup in which the victim shuffled along, stopped with each suspect in turn, then shuffled on. At a critical moment, she dropped a key on the floor. Foley was having trouble matching sound to picture on this last effect. I was struck by the fact that just as early radio announcers had worn dinner jackets, he was wearing an ultramarine tuxedo. After half a dozen attempts, he decided to call it quits and emerged from his sound booth like a diver from a bathysphere. He offered me a tidbit that tasted only of mesquite. I wanted to say something about Marina, something about an identity parade in which I once took part, something about the etymology of tuxedo. But I found myself savouring the play between Booth and Bathy, quits and mesquite, and began to misquote myself. Here's the verse part. You ready? When he sookied a calf down a boreen, it was through Indo-European. When he clicked at a donkey carting dung, your grandfather had an African tongue. You seem content to ventriloquize the surf. Foley swallowed whatever it was. Still defending that same old patch of turf? Have you forgotten that hoodlum is backslang for the leader of a San Francisco street gang? He flounced off into his cubicle. Though this, our only exchange, was remarkable for its banality, Foley has had some profound effect on me. These past 6 months, I've sometimes run a little ahead of myself. But mostly, I lag behind. My footfalls already preempted by their echoes. I'm reminded of that word lag. I'll read a poem called Lag, which has to do partly with the original Siamese twins, Chang and Eng. Some of you may have read a novel about their lives, published, I guess, 5 years ago, to great success, as I recall. And Chang and Eng, of course, spent a lot of their lives in showbiz. They were with Barnum and Bailey, for many years. They were married to twins, not conjoined twins like themselves, but twins nonetheless. And as you may recall, they had quite a number of children, something in the order of 15 or 16. And despite all this, despite their intimacy, as it were, things were not always well between Chang and Eng. So this is a poem that takes that notion and uses it as the conceit, I suppose, the basis of a metaphor having to do with a relationship that's not going particularly well. And the lag in the title refers to the gap between Greenwich Mean Time and Eastern Standard Time. I hope it'll work nonetheless here in the West Coast. If you'll just allow a little bit more, perhaps. Lag. We were joined at the hip. We were joined at the hip like some latter day Chang and Eng. Though I lay in that dreadful kip in North Carolina, while you preferred to hang loose in London, in that selfsame room in Bayswater. You wrapped yourself in a flag, the red flag with a white elephant of Siam, and contemplated the time lag. It was Chang, I seem to recall, who tried to choke Eng when he'd had one over the eight. It was Chang whose breath was always so sickly sour. It was Chang who suffered a stroke. Eng was forced to shoulder his weight. It was Chang who died first. Eng lived on for 5 hours. A little change of mood, I think. This is a nonsense poem. It's called Symposium. A symposium, as you know, a philosophical discussion taking place over a glass of wine, or perhaps two glasses of wine, maybe three, in the case of whoever is speaking this poem. It's not entirely clear to me, anyway. So there are moments of recognition, I suppose, in it. It's made up of parts of truisms, proverbs, well-known phrases and sayings, a bit of one violently connected to another. So, symposium. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it hold its nose to the grindstone and hunt with the hounds. Every dog has a stitch in time. Two heads, you've been sold one good turn. One good turn deserves a bird in the hand. A bird in the hand is better than no bread. To have your cake is to pay Paul. Make hay while you can still hit the nail on the head. For want of a nail, the sky might fall. People in glass houses can't see the wood for the new broom. Rome wasn't built between two stools. Empty vessels wait for no man. A hair of the dog is a friend indeed. There's no fool like the fool who shot his bolt. There's no smoke after the horse is gone. So this next one, just a couple more, I think we'll see us there. This next one is set in the house that we live in New Jersey, a state I'm very pleased to share with at least one other poet here this evening, Robert Pinsky. He was born in New Jersey. I've been reborn in New Jersey. Perhaps I've... Sorry. I'm sorry about that. I won't be saying that again. But anyway, I love New Jersey. And this is a poem that's set in the house we live in, part of which was built in about 1750. And in that era, when they were building a house, I don't think it was the same. From what I recall from the Golden Book of California, I don't think that was part of... Was it part of the technology here to use horsehair in the plaster? No, no. It was this an East Coast thing, I think. The horsehair to bind the plaster. So it's a poem having to do with a series of sensations, impressions, through a hole in a wall. And it has this little refrain, and the basis of it is the first time it occurs, it's with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. With a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. So please feel free to join in if I know Robert Pinsky will, if you're inclined. So here we go, the loaf. When I put my finger to the hole, they've cut for a dimmer switch. In a wall of plaster, stiffened with horsehair. It seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the gain, all the way from Raritan to the Delaware. With a clink and a clink and a clinky click. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain of the canal after a hurricane and the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain. With a stink and a stink and a stinky stick. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope, indeed, of washing out a few whole ears of grain, with a wink and a winky wick. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair-fringed niche, I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed, with a link and a link and a linky lick. And I'll end with a little song lyric, if I may. I started off with the Cowboys, and the other great genre of that era, which is making something of a comeback, perhaps, was the sword and sandals movie genre. And so this little poem that refers to that, it's called Don't Try This at Home. You may buckle your sword and sandals to fight off the Goths and Vandals, now they've dented your chrome. Just don't sit around to count the cost of every shiny thing you've lost back in the catacombs. Do what you must when you're in Rome. Just don't try this at home. You may argue from strength comes sweetness when that lovely deem at meetness lights the Pantheon dome. Just don't reach into the lion's mouth and run the risk of going south all for a honeycomb. Do what you must when you're in Rome. Just don't try this at home. I'm not putting up with your yakety-yak on the Rossies and Bianchis. I'm not cutting you any more slack than the Red Sox cut the Yankees. I'm not turning a blind eye if your husband comes crawling back for a little hanky-panky and you give him a great big high. Do what you must when you're in Rome. Just don't try this at home. You may revel in what it entails to have sprung from your own entrails like Venus from the foam. Just don't soak it up like the bloody sand when things got kind of out of hand back in the Hippodrome. Do what you must when you're in Rome. Just don't try this at home. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul Muldoon. Linda Gregerson is the chair of the final judging panel for the Kingsley and Kate Tufts Awards. She's a poet, literary critic, and professor of English at the University of Michigan, where she teaches American poetry and Renaissance literature. She received her BA from Oberlin College, an MA from Northwestern University, an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and her PhD from Stanford. Her books of poetry include Fire in the Conservatory, The Woman Who Died in Her Sleep, Waterborne, and most recently, Magnetic North. She's also the author of two works of literary criticism, The Reformation of the Subject, Spencer, Milton, and the English Protestant Epic, and Negative Capability, Contemporary American Poetry. Her volume of poetry, The Woman Who Died in Her Sleep, was a finalist for both the Poets' Prize and the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. Waterborne won the 2002 Kingsley Tufts Prize. Magnetic North was a 2007 National Book Award finalist. Other honors include awards from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Poetry Society of America, Poetry Magazine, and the Modern Poetry Association, in addition to fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Institute for Advanced Study, the National Humanities Center, and the National Endowment for the Arts. As a scholar, she's been honored with the Isabel McCaffrey Award from the Spencer Society. Of her two primary occupations, Linda once said, and I quote, "The scholarly work and the poetry work are foundationally different things, but one is a methodological escape from the other. It's good and necessary for my scholarship to siphon off other kinds of thinking and associational work that would burden it, work that would make too belletristic, too idiosyncratic, too self-indulgent. Those are not, to me, imaginable dangers for Linda, but clearly this has proved a winning formula. And please join me in welcoming Linda Gregerson."
Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you, Louise Steinem and the Library Foundation, for having us here this evening. I'm immensely honored to be reading with two poets whom I admire so enormously, as I do Paul Muldoon and Robert Pinsky. I'm going to begin with a poem from Magnetic North. Sweet. "Linda," said my mother when the buildings fell. "Before, you understand, we knew a thing about the reasons or the ways and means, while we were still dumbfounded, still bereft of likely narratives. We cannot continue to live in a world where we have so much and other people have so little." "Sweet," he said, "your mother's wrong, but sweet, the world has never self-corrected. You Americans break my heart. Our possum, she must be hungry or she wouldn't venture out in so much daylight, has found a way to maneuver on top of the snow. Thin crust, sometimes her foot breaks through. The edge of the woods for safety, or for safety's hopeful look-alike. Die Delphus, double wound. Which is to say, our one marsupial. The shelter, then the early birth, then shelter perforce again. Virginiana for the place. The place for a queen supposed to have her maidenhead. He was clever. He had moved among the powerful. Our possum, possessed of 13 teats, or so my book informs me, quite a ready-made republic, guides her blind and all but embryonic young to their pouch by licking a path from the birth canal. Resourceful, no? Requiring commendable limberness, as does the part I've seen, the part where she ferries the juveniles on her back. Another pair of eyes above her shoulder. Sweet. The place construed as yet to be written upon by us. And many lost, as when their numbers exceed the sources of milk, or when the weaker ones fall by the wayside. There are principles at work, no doubt. Beholding a world of harm, the mind will apprehend some bringer of harm, some cause or course that might have been otherwise had we possessed the wit to see, or ruthlessness, or what, or heart. My mother's mistake, if that's the best the world as we've made it can make of her, hasn't much altered with better advice. Its holy premise, rather like the crusted snow. The resurrection of the body. She must have been 13 or so, her nascent breasts just showing above the Velcro strap that held her in her chair, her face translucent, beautiful, as if a cheekbone might directly render a tranquil heart, and yet the eyes were all disquietude. The mother, with her miraculous smile, frequent, durable, lifted the handkerchief. You know the way a woman will, her index finger guiding a corner, the body of it gathered in her dexterous palm. And with such tenderness, wiped the spittle pooling at her daughter's mouth, the faint, warm smell of lipstick, remember, freighted with love, and with that distillate left by fear, when fear's been long outdone by fearful fact. The mother would give her soul to see this child lift her head on her own. And down the hall in orthotics, I couldn't for the longest time understand why the boy required a helmet so complexly fitted and strong. His legs were unused, his arms so thin. Treadmill, I thought. Or a bicycle, maybe some bold new stage of therapy anyway. Sometimes he falls and, safe in his helmet, can bravely get to work again. It wasn't for nothing that I was so slow. Who cannot read these waiting rooms has so far, exactly so far, been spared. It was only while I was driving home, my daughter in her car seat with her brand new brace, that I thought of the boy's rhythmic rocking and knew. Green light, yellow, the tide of pedestrians flush and smooth, and the boy's poor head against the wall. How could I miss it? And what does God in his heaven do then? The boy's poor head in its bright red helmet knocking, listen, to be let in. I think the primary enduring mystery of my life, certainly, I imagine our lives, is the mystery of living in a body. I'm a great admirer of the body. I am in awe of its intelligence. It is much, much smarter than we are. If we had to do on purpose a fraction of the things our bodies do on our behalf, we would be doomed. And sometimes it's when the body goes wrong that its splendor really is lifted to visibility. I haven't yet read the new biography of Flannery O'Connor, but I was stunned by a phrase excerpted in one of the reviews. O'Connor, as you may remember, had to retire to her family home at a very early age, and because she was quite ill with lupus, and lived the rest of her life under its shadow and died at a very early age. She said to a friend at one point about her illness that it had been more instructive than a long trip to Europe. And I thought that was Flannery O'Connor. So this poem is more instructive than a long trip to Europe. The wolf, she meant, the lupus, which we also yoke with butterfly. Broad curves across the cheekbone's finest lesions and the narrow bridge across the nose. What can I tell you, says body to soul, to make you understand? There is a system so exquisite in solicitude for every least unlocking that sustains you, every atom scanned for friend or foe. It forms the very script of self-cohering. In its zeal, sometimes, it goes too far. As if where you'd always thought home was, they should suddenly take your papers away and ask you why you've come here, and no phone calls why you're plotting harm. The body turns against itself. And why should it not be brilliant in this newest fevered cause as in its every other aptitude? Salerno, late 12th century, Roger Fugard writes his book. And thinking wolf bite gives disease a name. No way, of course, to know the inner workings, but he has his Galen, has his university, medieval on the Roman stones. Its lovely crenellations grace the painting in my guidebook. And he has his eyes. A king has come to kneel before the surgeons, see his many retainers, the weight of his robes. Behold the faith we've always placed in learning, and the feral counter-argument encoded in the blood. This next poem is written in four sections. You'll see each section has a different, they're different scenes, so there are really four, they're four linked scenes, but each one has a different referent, really, and context in mind. The first is a newspaper photograph that appeared on my birthday in 2006 in The Guardian, and that I carried around for 2.5 years with me everywhere, actually, before I finally tried to write about it. The second section has a movie in mind and a scene, no sandals, alas, and no horses. But there is a horse actually. But it's a scene you'll probably recognize. It's from Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List, and it's about it's a scene that Schindler I won't go on and on, but it's a very interesting scene about point of view, and it's Schindler, in fact, who is on horseback, is seeing from a hilltop what turns out to be the clearing of the Krakow ghetto. Scene three is self-explanatory, and four returns us to the title of the poem, which is Still Life. One. His ears, his mouth, his nostrils having filled with ash, his cheekbones, chin, all ash, and on the ash a tide of sea wrack that cannot be right, a trail of scum or vomit then, and either his shoulders been crushed by the blast or angled on the stretcher so oddly that raising his arm to ward us off, he seems to be more damaged than he is. And eyes that should have cracked the camera. This was not the current nightmare. This was two or three nightmares ago. The men were loading plums and peaches onto trucks at Kaa. And though in my lucky and ignorant life I have never so much as encountered the scent of explosives, I had taken a different bus that day. The city I live in is thicker with doctors than all of Baka is thick with bombs. I've seen those eyes before exactly. Failures of decency closer to home. Two. The clearing of the ghetto. Red wool, and falsely brightened since we need the help. A child, because the chambers of the heart will hold so little. If the filmmaker, having apprenticed in fables, proposes a scale for which he hopes we're apt, and if this bigger than a bread box, slightly smaller than the microwave, is just about the vista we can manage, let's agree to call it history. Let's imagine we had somehow seen its face in time. But where in all of Krakow is the mother who buttoned her coat? A city steeped in harm to come, the film stock drained to gray. The sturdy threading forward of a child who might be panicked by the crowd, but has her mind now on a hiding place. Our childlike conviction that she shall be spared. Mistake that brings the lesson home. We lack retention. Chalk mark on a clouded screen. Three. But what was it like, his dying? It was like a distillation. You had morphine? We had morphine, but he couldn't use the bed. The bed. His lungs were so thickened with tumors and phlegm, he had no way of breathing there. You'd rented the bed. He climbed down beside it and asked for his tools. When something was broken, he fixed it. That had always been the way with him. So then we left him in his chair. But as the day went on, we thought he needed bedding, so we tried to lift him. That's the once he blamed us. That's the look you meant. The why can't you people just leave me alone? The where is your sense of shame? I will remember it until I die myself. You meant well. Meaning well was not enough. We meant that he should know this wasn't lost on us. The urn that holds his ashes does a better job. Four. Sister Partridge, Brother Hare, the linen on the table with its hem stitch. I have read the books on pridefulness, the bounty of game park and sideboard and loom, the ships that brought the lemon trees, the leisure that masters the view. But I have come to think the argument by likeness makes a simpler point. The lemon, for example, where the knife has been, the pores, the pith, the luminescent heart of it, each differential boundary bound to open. Meaning death, of course, the unprotected flesh about to turn, but just before the turn, while looking, can still be an act of praise. I see you in the mirror every morning where you wait for me. The linen father, lemon, knife, the pewter with its lovely reluctance to shine, as though the given world had given us a second chance. And I'll end with a kind of love poem to my wonderful niece, Rebecca, who was going through a kind of rough time in her life when I wrote this poem, and who I'm thrilled to say is going through a wonderful time of her life right now. She's in college now. She's on her swim team. She's a chem major taking 3 labs. She's 6 feet tall and has bright red hair. She condescends to me a lot. The poem's called Prodigal. Copper and ginger, the plentiful mass of it bound, half loosed, and bound again in lavish disregard as though such heaping up were a thing indifferent. Surfeit from the table of the gods who do not give a thought to fairness, no, who throw their bounty in a single lap. The chipped enamel, blue on her nails, the lashes sticky with sunlight. You would swear she hadn't a thought in her head except for her buttermilk waffle and its just proportion of jam. But while she laughs and chews, half singing with the lyrics on the radio, half shrugging out of her bathrobe in the kitchen warmth, she doesn't quite complete the last part. One of the sleeves, as though you'd swear she couldn't be bothered, still covers her arm, which means you do not see the cuts. Girls of an age, 15, for example, still bearing the traces of when they were new, of when the breasts had not been thought of, when the troublesome cleft was smooth, are anchored on a fault line. It's a wonder they survive at all. This ginger-haired darling isn't one of my own, if own is ever the way to put it, but I've known her since her heart could still be seen at work beneath the fontanelles. Her skin was almost otherworldly, touch so silken it seemed another kind of sight, a subtler boundary than obtains for all the rest of us. Though ordinary mortals bear some remnant too, consider the loved one's fine-grained inner arm. And so it's there, from wrist to elbow, that she cuts. She takes her scissors to that perfect page. She's good. She isn't stupid. She can see that we who are children of plenty have no excuse for suffering. We should be ashamed, and so she is. And so she has produced this many-layered hieroglyphic, channels raw, half-healed, reopened before the healing gains momentum. She has taken for her copy text the very cogs and wheels of time. And as for her other body, says the plain song on the morning news, the hole in the ozone, the fish in the sea, you were thinking what exactly? You were thinking a comfortable breakfast would help. I thought we'd deal with that tomorrow. Then you'll have to think again. Thank you.
Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate of the United States and Kingsley Tufts judge, received his bachelor's degree from Rutgers University and his PhD from Stanford. He taught at Wellesley College from 1968 to 1980 and at UC Berkeley from 1980 to 1988 before moving to Boston University, where he remains today. His books of poetry include Sadness and Happiness, An Explanation of America, History of My Heart and Dying, both in the same year, The Want Bone, Shirt, The Figured Wheel, New and Collected Poems, 1966-1996, which earned him a Penn Volcker Award and a Pulitzer Prize nomination, Jersey Rain, Samurai Song, and Gulf Music Poems in 2007. He earned a Guggenheim Fellowship and William Carlos Williams Prize in 2003. He's achieved fame as a translator, editor, and educator, as well as a poet. In 1994, he completed his extraordinary translation of Dante's Inferno, which became a New York Times bestseller and Book of the Month selection, as well as receiving the Los Angeles Times Book Review Award and the Howard Morton Landon Prize for Translation. And apparently, I hear, when asked his inspiration for the work, he responded, "It was an accident, an assignment to do one canto for a group project." A wonderful accident. From 1997 to 2000, Robert Pinsky served as the 9th Poet Laureate of the United States. Part of his duty as laureate was to raise public interest in poetry, and in 1997, he established the Favorite Poem Program, the project originally conceived as 100 average Americans reading their favorite poems to be compiled in an archive in the Library of Congress. Received an overwhelming public response. In 1 year, there were over 18,000 submissions from readers ranging in age from 5 to 97. The project has been featured on NewsHour, and he's edited Poems to Read, An Invitation to Poetry, and most recently, in 2009, Essential Pleasures, a new anthology of poems to read aloud. Robert Pinsky edits poetry for Slate and is columnist for the Washington Post under the title Poet's Choice. Please welcome Robert Pinsky.
Many thanks, and it is truly an honor to be here with Linda Gregerson and Paul Muldoon. And all three of us feel very proud of having chosen Bethea Harvey and Matthew Dickman for these prizes. I'll start with a kind of a love poem, a phrase that Linda used about that heartbreaking, beautiful poem about her niece. This poem is as though, I guess I'm thinking of my mom and dad, but also Adam and Eve, and probably someone I love, and me. Antique. I drowned in the fire of having you. I burned in the river of not having you. We lived together for hours in a house of 1,000 rooms, and we were parted for 1,000 years. 10 minutes ago, we raised our children, who cover the earth and have forgotten that we existed. It was not the illusion of Maya. It was not a ladder to perfection. It was this cold sunlight falling on this warm earth. When I turned, you went to hell. When your ship fled the battle, I followed you and lost the world without regret, but with stormy recrimination. Someday, far down that corridor of horror, the future, someone who buys this picture of you for the frame, at a stall in a dwindled city. We'll study your face and decide to harbor it for a little while longer from the waters of anonymity, the acids of breath. I'll read another of the short poems, shorter poems from this recent book, Gulf Music. This is a poem called Rhyme, and the poem does rhyme, but each stanza uses the same sequence of end sounds, so that the rhymes are, I hope, audible, but I guess I hope barely so. In the past, it's always been in this book, and turns out it still is. So the first line of each stanza is tongue, song, among, rung, and there's inherit, parrot, share it, etc. Rhyme. Air, an instrument of the tongue. The tongue, an instrument of the body. The body, an instrument of spirit. The spirit, a being of the air. A bird, the medium of its song, each song a world, a containment, like a hotel room, ready for us guests who inherit our compartment of time there. In the Cornell box, among ephemera as its element, the preserved bird, a study in spontaneous elegy, the parrot, art, mortal in its cornered sphere. The room, a stanza rung in a laddered filament chambered by all the unsteady chambered voices that share it, each reciting, I too was here. In a room, a rhyme, a song, in the box, in books, each element an instrument, the body still straining to parrot the spirit, a being of air. The word instrument reminds me of a recent poem not yet in a book, Last Robot Song. The poem imagines a robot, a little robot who's still there after the people are gone, and the robot doesn't know what to do. Like most of us, it's an intelligent recorder. So it sings to itself, and it sings these myths that the humans have given it. It's our stories. Last Robot Song. It was a little newborn god that made the first instrument. Sweet vibration of mind, mind, mind enclosed in its orbit. The little newborn god scooped out a turtle's shell and strung it with a rabbit's guts. Oh, what a stroke to invent music from an empty case strung with bloody filaments, the wiry rabbit flesh plucked or strummed, pulled taut across the gutted, resonant hull of the turtle. Music from an empty shell and the insides of a rabbit. Sweet conception, sweet instrument of mind, mind, mind. Mind itself a capable vibration, thrumming from here to there in the cloven brain flesh contained in its helmet of bone, like an electronic box full of channels and filaments bundled inside its case, a little musical robot dreamed up by the mind, embedded in the brain with its blood-warm channels and its humming network of neurons, engendering the newborn baby god, as clever and violent as his own instrument of sweet, all-consuming imagination, held by its own vibration, mind, mind, mind pulled taut in its bony shell, dreaming up heaven and hell. Samurai Song. Samurai Song. When I had no roof, I made audacity my roof. When I had no supper, my eyes dined. When I had no eyes, I listened. When I had no ears, I thought. When I had no thought, I waited. When I had no father, I made care my father. When I had no mother, I embraced order. When I had no friend, I made quiet my friend. When I had no enemy, I opposed my body. When I had no temple, I made my voice my temple. I have no priest. My tongue is my choir. When I have no means, fortune is my means. When I have nothing, death will be my fortune. Need is my tactic. Detachment is my strategy. When I had no lover, I courted my sleep. The book, Gulf Music, it's sort of partly a book of rage at the Bush administration and partly a book about remembering and forgetting. This is a poem called The Forgetting. The forgetting I notice most as I get older is really a form of memory. The undergrowth of things unknown to you young that I have forgotten. Memory of so much crap, jumbled with so much that seems to matter. Lieutenant Callie, Captain Easy, Mei Ling Sung, Sibi Sisti. And all the forgettings that preceded my own, Baghdad, Egypt, Greece, the plains, centuries of lootings of antiquities, obscure atrocities. Imagine a big tent filled with mostly kids yelling for poetry. In fact, it happened. I was there in New Jersey at the famous poetry show. I used to wonder, what if the Baseball Hall of Fame overflowed with too many thousands of greats? All in time unremembered. Hardly anybody can name all eight of their great-grandparents. Can you? Will your children's grandchildren remember your name? You'll see, you little young jerks. Your favorite music and your political furores, too, will need to get sorted in dusty electronic corridors. In 1972, Zhou Enlai was asked the lasting effects of the French Revolution. Quote, too soon to tell. Remember? Or was it Mao Zedong? Poetry made out of air strains to reach back to begats and suspiring forward into air, grunting to beget the hungry or overfed future. Ezra Pound praises the emperor who appointed a committee of scholars to pick the best 450 no plays and destroy all the rest. The fascist. The stand-up master Stephen Wright says he thinks he suffers from both amnesia and déjà vu. Quote, I feel like I have forgotten this before. Who remembers the arguments when jurors gave Ezra Pound the only prize for poetry awarded by the United States government until then? I was in the big tent when the guy read his poem about how the Jews were warned to get out of the Twin Towers before the planes hit. The crowd was applauding and screaming. They were happy. It isn't that they were anti-Semitic or anything. They just weren't listening, or no, they were listening, but that certain way. In it comes, you hear it, and that self-same second you swallow it or expel it. An ecstasy of forgetting. And I'll close, as I close this book, with a kind of, I allow myself a kind of distorted translation from Dante. This is from the last canto of Paradise. And I think it is just to say that in these lines, Dante accepts his own place in that rhythm of forgetting and remembering. He understands he will die. He understands that people, those work, he knows his work will be deeply admired for centuries. He understands that everyone will not spend all their life thinking about his work. And he understands his extinction and accepts it as part of that process. This is my slightly tilted translation of those lines, and I skipped three lines. There's one terzina where Dante says, San Bernardo told me to look up, and I was already looking up where he told me to look. I didn't get it, so I skipped it. So I will close again. Bless the Claremont Graduate University. I'm grateful to it for giving me these colleagues, Linda Gregerson and Paul Muldoon, and for participating in all these prizes that we've given, and this year to these wonderful poets, Harvey and Dickman. It's really great. This is from the last canto of Paradise. Paradiso 33, lines 46, 48, and 52, 66. I'm going to annotate it. I'm going to say something about it. He borrows the myth of the Sibyl from Virgil. The Sibyl knows everything. She knew everything. She knew everything that had happened, everything that would happen. And she wrote it down. And Virgil says that everyone loathed the Sibyl because she had written it all down, but she wrote it on these very fine leaves. And as soon as the door to the temple, her temple, began to turn on its hinges, that slight breeze sent the leaves up into confusion. And that's why people loathe the Sibyl. For me, that is an image of the idea that knowledge is real. There is such a thing as knowledge. There's such a thing as anticipation and retrospection, and all of those things are real, but very difficult, almost impossible. It's real, but it's very hard to grasp it or hold on to it. From the last canto of Paradise, as I drew nearer to the end of all desire, I brought my longing's ardor to a final height, just as I ought. My vision, becoming pure, entered more and more the beam of that high light that shines on its own truth. From then, my seeing became too large for speech, which fails at a sight beyond all boundaries, at memory's undoing, as when the dreamer sees, and after the dream the passion endures, imprinted on his being, though he can't recall the rest. I am the same. Inside my heart, although my vision is almost entirely faded, droplets of its sweetness do come, the way the sun dissolves the snow's crust, the way in the wind that stirred the light leaves, the oracle that the Sibyl wrote was lost. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.